Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
Always, always, all of the times.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Sad trombone.
Hey, we can hear you now. I could hear you last week. But our guest this week is an old friend. You probably haven't heard from him in quite a while. It's Nathan Mustafa.
Well, hello. I'm back from my long hiatus.
Exile.
I don't know what made me think to invite you, Nathan, because I haven't heard from you in a long time, except maybe through Twitter, but you were always so good on the newscast, and you were on RFN a long time ago, so it's very good to have you back, sir.
Well, thanks for having me.
And actually, I think I had seen something on maybe Miiverse, or you'd added me on Nintendo Network, and I thought, oh, he still plays Nintendo stuff.
Of course.
We should get him on the show. Even in your retirement. So, we're going to talk to you about some Nintendo stuff. We got a lot of games to talk about this week, and coming up in the second segment, we have a lot of listener mail that we're going to get through as much as possible. As usual, we probably won't make it through everything I picked out, but we're going to try. So, first up this week, I figured since Guillaume lost his new business last week, poor guy, let's let him go first and catch up on a couple things.
All right, sure. But first, before I begin, James, it's about time for a break, right? Do you want to go get some water?
Uh-oh. Are we going to talk about Sonic?
Yeah, I've been playing a lot of Sonic and All-Star Racing Transformed for the Wii U.
So many words.
I got it digitally because, you know, like you get 399 points back, and $40 wasn't really too much to ask. And I was pretty confident that I was going to A, like the game, and B, probably play it for a long time, not try to trade it in. So yeah, that's worked out great so far, because I've gotten perhaps 102 stars out of probably 200 in the main campaign. So yeah, I've made some progress. I've been playing a lot, mostly single player stuff, and the game is fantastic. I know that usually, you know, you think of mascot kart racing, you think of Mario Kart, and this is that's the game that Sonic gets compared to. But I think the game so far reminds me more of Excitebots. I haven't played a lot of Excite Trucks, but Excitebots definitely, it's just, you know, about as fast. And the way that the terrain deforms and the chaos, you know, it's much closer to that game than to Mario Kart. You do have weapons, you do have kind of the equivalent of a blue shell, except much, much more tame, much less frustrating.
It's more fair.
Yeah, yeah. And the weapons slow you down, they don't completely stop you. There's a lot of frustration in Mario Kart 7, I find, where you get hit by a shell, and perhaps you're going up an incline, but then, like, you stop completely, and you start rolling back down. And it's extremely frustrating. But in this game, it doesn't really happen. You always kind of have some momentum going, except for a few cases where, unfortunately, you get kind of you hit a snag in the surroundings, and you kind of stop dead in your tracks. I could do without that. It's really jarring when it happens.
Well, it's a Sonic game, right?
It is. It is.
So, I mean, there got to be a lot of blind curves with spike pits, I'm guessing.
There we go!
Yeah. Yep.
It's really not like that, though. I bought this, too, over the weekend, and because the Digital Deluxe program started. So I logged into that, and I had $10 worth of credits, because I bought my first two Wii U games, Mario and Assassin's Creed, online. So I had $10 off, and I said, well, if I put this on Sonic and All-Stars, then I get it for $30. That's like nothing. It's like free.
It's like
and
free.
They had just put out the patch to fix it, and apparently the patch worked. You know, everybody was saying, wow, this fixed all my problems with the game. So I said, okay, sure, sounds great. And I checked with Guillaume, and he recommended it. So I downloaded it. I've been having a blast with it so far. I've only played a few hours. I would say I already enjoy this more than Mario Kart 7. It just feels fresher. It's faster, more fun. The levels are way more interesting and very dynamic. And I really like the The boating's okay. It does feel a bit like Hydro Thunder, but it slows you down so much that I'm not sure I like it as much. But the flying parts are really great.
Yeah, so, well, part of the strategy during a course is to try to avoid the boat or try to be in the air as much as you can because the jets are faster. And there are some shortcuts that you can take to allow you to stay in the air longer or to get into your jet earlier in a race. So there is that kind of strategy involved. When you do know the shortcuts, you definitely have a leg up on the others. And most of the tracks, the tracks where it's mostly water are very rare. Ironically, I guess, the Burning Rangers, track is the one where it's mostly water most of the time. that one I don't like quite as much, although the music that plays in the background is just so mind-blowing that it does make the level more bearable. I've never played that game in the arcades, but if the music is anything to go by, it's a gem. I don't have a whole lot of nostalgia for Sega franchises, so a lot of these, you know, kind of Dreamcast era characters are kind of lost on me. I have to say that the Sonic characters are probably the most prevalent in the game, which probably makes sense. Like, they're definitely the most popular. But they're also, like, it becomes quite clear quite quickly that they're also the worst designs. I just, like, Amy? Like, what the fuck? Like, she's just like a pink Sonic.
She's a pink Sonic in drag, yes.
Ah, it's pretty awful. Like, it's kind of funny because one of the things that is unfortunate about the game is that it's one of those games that some people would want to play only multiplayer, but all of the unlockables you have to play the single player mode. I don't know why they did that. Well, I know that they probably wanted to show off like their mission mode and, you know, make people play through that, but I don't think it's a particularly good idea. It would have been nice to just be able to unlock the new characters by doing something else in the game.
There's no alternate conditions to do that?
Not to my knowledge. You can...
Even playing online?
Yep. If you play online, you gain, or if you play just any kind of racing at any time, you do gain experience points for each character, and that unlocks mods, which are basically just like stat changes for that character. But you can't unlock like half of the roster. So you absolutely have to do the missions. Thankfully, they're pretty well done. I have been enjoying that part of the game. There's not that much variety, but what is there is not filler. You know, like there's no type of mission that I get to that's, I'm just like, ah, shit, not this again. And most of them are basically like finish in the first three or finish first during this race. So it's, you know, it's pretty painless. It's what you would do anyway. But there are some drifting missions. There are some time attacks. There are some where you have to boost constantly or else your timer starts going down. And if you run out of time, you lose. So you have to hit the boost pads. You have to drift. You have to use everything that you can. So yeah, it's very, very good. Where was I going with this? Oh yeah, like I was going to say doing the missions, you can see you've got some sort of tree of missions that you can go through. Your view of that tree is very limited. You don't really see where each branch, goes to. So you just try to, you know, get stars in all of them. And at some point you might hit a point where you unlock a new character. You're going to see his silhouette. And there was one silhouette that was very, very, very clearly Shadow the Hedgehog. I came so close to just not bothering.
Skip. Oh, it's the Chaotix crew. Delete save.
There's another silhouette that's, tall and lanky and has a ponytail. And last night I unlocked Danica Patrick, and she kind of sucks in the game, from what I can tell.
Yeah,
but it is funny. I mean, they've cartoonized her enough that it doesn't look completely ridiculous that she's in the race with these.
But it is still completely ridiculous.
With these animals and But, yeah, I mean, let me put it this way. I don't think she's any weirder in the game than, like, BD Joe from Crazy Taxi, who spits Crazy Taxi phrases the entire time he's racing and is quite hilarious.
BD Joe makes more fucking sense in a kart game than Sonic does, and he's in the title. Checkmate!
You know, like, naturally, I've been sticking with some of the... unfortunately, you have to unlock them, but I've been sticking with Joe Hisashi from Shinobi. Also, Vice from Skies of Arcadia. I gotta say, like, Joe Hisashi is just... he's gonna lighten up. Like, he's just always, you know, gotta stick up in his ass. And when you lose, he's just...
kills your family.
I will not live in shame. Or, to lose is not an option. Like, come on, lighten up. You're racing against, like, a pink hedgehog.
That's funny. It's a very lighthearted game, though, overall.
Oh, yeah. Very. Oh, yeah.
I mean, James, I know some people were annoyed with you a couple weeks ago when you were laughing at this game so hard. And, yeah, I mean, the way it seems like the condition this game was launched was unacceptable, obviously, to Sega as well. And but now that they've patched it, I got to tell you, I mean, the greatest revenge of all those people on you, James Jones, is that this game is pretty awesome.
Yep.
It really is.
Look, I didn't laugh at the game's existence. I laughed at the fact it was released half finished.
Sure. And to be fair, you're consistent. You're an equal opportunity offender with that stuff. You really, really hate buggy game releases.
I work in software. When somebody that works with me puts out buggy code, I excoriate them for it because it hurts our reputation.
You know, that's something I run into all the time reviewing iOS games, and I will hand out 1-star reviews for games that are buggy and, you know, essentially unplayable in parts, and I'll get entire forum threads on Touch Arcade dedicated to what an idiot I am. It's like, well, you don't understand. This is a game someone's asking money for, and it's not playable for the majority of the people who buy it. That's just not acceptable. There's too much out there to, you know, okay, you know, I bought this game, but let me wait around and hopefully they'll fix it someday.
I mean, when I look at something like that, you've spent at least 6 months on this game. Have some pride. Finish it.
Well, and you're not calling it a beta, and you're charging people money. That's the line.
To me, it would be embarrassing to release stuff in some of the state. I mean, I've got review copies before where I'm like, I couldn't sleep if I put this game out. I would, I would be up for weeks just devastated.
Yeah.
Or you could get your ass in gear and fix it. And that's what the guys who made Sonic and Sega All-Star Racing.
That's great.
And look, I mean, iOS is one thing, and that platform's been around for years. I don't understand the rush to get something out that you would do it with bugs.
The world needs this alligator puzzle game right now.
But this is a Wii U launch game, and launch is an important marketing date. And the guys on the team, you know, probably would have liked to have more time, and maybe that was the publisher said, no, the game's coming out this day. You can finish it later. It's going to be on the shelf on launch day.
Someone made a stupid decision.
Yeah, and I don't know who that was, and I'm, you know, I mean, you call it out, and you can make fun of the game for it all you want, but once they fix it, that's where James and I disagree, is that once the game is patched, I forget all that. I don't care how it was released. It's in the past. I really don't give a shit. They fixed it, and now it's good.
And my bet is that the stupid decision did not come from the developer, you know.
Like but you know, people got mad that I said this, but Sega does have a history of this.
Sure. Yeah. So does Bethesda.
And we,
you know,
and I've
so
made
does
fun
Rockstar.
Of Bethesda for 20 minutes after they released the patch that made the dragon fly backwards.
Sure.
I'm consistent.
That was a feature.
You are very consistent. It's not that you specifically hate Sega.
Anyway, the good news is it was patched when I bought it. It's still patched now, and people can buy it and without fear. It's pretty good.
Get the complete game.
All right, so Guillaume, what else you been playing?
I have been reviewing a little game on the eShop, the 3DS eShop, called Crimson Shroud. It's the third game now in the Guild 01 series. So it's a Mitsuno-developed RPG, and you're asking, what the hell is that? Mitsuno is the mind behind the Tactics Ogre games. Ogre Battle as well, right?
Yep.
Okay. Same guy. Yeah.
And Final Fantasy Tactics, all those games. I have not really. I played maybe 10 hours of Ogre Battle 64, so I wasn't really familiar. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not really that familiar with his work.
And good games.
This is a game that apes tabletop RPGs, which I also have no experience with. So, obviously, I was the perfect person to review this game. it's pretty cool. Immediately, like, all I knew about the game was, you know, like, the pedigree and the fact that it had dice in it. I had no idea that it was going to go so far in its presentation as to have your characters be figurines. They are static. Like, initially, I thought, like, the music is great. It seems to be really, really well-written. But the characters don't move. I guess that's where they saved money. Like, I know these games are small and that they probably didn't have a huge budget. So I guess this is where they cut everything.
But, you know, Guillaume, if you have played a tabletop game and I managed to get a Crimson Shroud during the course of the day, it does invoke that feeling. You know, like, you can tell they're going for that style. You've got your figures on the board and it's very intentionally trying to evoke the feeling.
Oh, yeah. Like, initially, like, the problem is, initially, I didn't notice that they had their feet stuck in the base. Like, I didn't realize that they were figurines. I thought they were just, characters. And then combat starts, and the goblins show up, and you hit them, and they wobble on their base. And I'm just, okay, that's pretty cute. So, yeah, that part of the presentation is really, really well done. And they go so far as to... So if you shake your dice hard enough, one of your dice would just skip from the bottom screen to the top screen and bop one of the figurines on the head. And at that point, like, it becomes one of your bonus die and that you can use for a later date. So, you know, like, that's pretty cool. The game is hard to understand at first. It's got a lot of systems. You can do combos. By basically not chaining up the water spell after an earth spell, you know, otherwise you kind of break the chain. And if you can keep a chain going like that, you gain bonus die. And you don't roll the dice all the time. Like, there's normal attacks, you cast spells, you use skills, like you would normally in an RPG. But occasionally, like, let's say you want to gain more mana points, then you might have to roll the dice. Or if you want to do a normal attack, you can see on the screen what the percentage of chance that you have of hitting the target and how much damage that you're going to do. And you can choose to basically assign one of your bonus die to one of these two stats to try to increase your chances.
So, Guillaume, I know you had a major bug. Not a bug, but you got stuck when you were playing it, and I saw you and Jeremy Parrish on Twitter going back and forth talking about it, and he helped you figure out where to go to get the item that you needed. And it's a little complicated to explain. I think people should read your review. If they're interested in this, it sounds like there really should be kind of a fair warning. You should know about this ahead of time so you don't get stuck at the same place.
Yeah, I basically flat out said, gave the quote-unquote solution, because there's no hint in the game that there's actually something that you should do.
It's not really a puzzle. It's more just a kind of really obscure point.
Yeah, and, you know, you might actually do the steps to fulfill the requirements, but not get the item that you need. So, like, you have to do a very specific thing, and you have to do it several times until, by chance, you get the item that you need. So, do read the review if you get stuck, because otherwise it's not going to be very enjoyable.
But overall, it seemed like you really, really like this. And I know a couple of guys on the Famicast crew were playing it when it first came out on Guild Zero One.
They all hated it.
They really hated it. Like, I think they were disappointed. I think this was probably the one in that series that they were the most excited about.
Yeah, it's the one I was the most excited about. Of course, that's not...
Well, of course it would be, James. But it sounds like maybe it just wasn't what they were expecting, or maybe they got stuck in the same place you did. I'm not sure.
I know that Don has downloaded the North American or European, I guess North American version of the game, and he's saying on Twitter that he enjoys it more now. He's saying that the English localization seems to be better than the Japanese original.
Yeah, the game is really dependent on the tone the text sets at the start.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's really nice.
Yeah, I agree. It's some lines I have kind of an issue with, but if you just imagine that's just the dungeon master being stupid, then it becomes acceptable.
You know, I'm curious, Guillaume, during the story, do they let you make decisions based on your character's skills or,
no,
I guess, your preferences and roll dice?
Well, yeah, like sometimes, occasionally, you'll have, an arrow is coming your way, you know, roll the dice and you can avoid it or not. Okay. The both times that I went through that situation, I succeeded. So I don't know if you can actually, get hit in the face with an arrow. But I do know that at some points the game does ask you, like, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? And it keeps tracks of that, but it didn't seem like the outcome was different. I guess that's a disappointment there.
But hey, it's a short, like, bite-sized RPG on 3DS, and you can download it for, what, 10 bucks?
8 bucks.
Eight? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Why don't I own this yet?
Yeah, really.
You really should.
I'm thinking the same thing.
I was playing it as we were talking, and then Guillaume said the music was nice, so I turned it off.
Well, okay, so I'm definitely going to check this game out. But my question to you, Guillaume, is, knowing that you have a PSP Go, why haven't you played Final Fantasy Tactics?
That's a good question. I don't think
on that, bro. That's one of the best games ever made.
I think that the game took a long time to get on the PSN shop.
Oh, that could be.
All the Square Enix games did.
But it's part of PlayStation Plus now, but only for Vita.
No, I think that, actually, I think I might, I'm not sure if I can actually use the copy that I got through PSN Plus, but I did download it to my PS3, so at some point I'm going to try to move it to my PSP.
Yeah, you should be able to put it on there.
Oh, okay.
If not, it's 10 bucks.
It's just, you know, I've been thinking about it, but then, you know, there's Majora's Mask just hanging over my head and like that. So it will
Fair
have to
enough.
Wait.
Hey, it's a big-ass game. I mean, I think I put over 100 hours on Final Fantasy Tactics, and I was renting it.
You know, one final thing I want to say, like, maybe that's why I enjoyed this game so much. It seems like a good bite-sized RPG that offers, you know, a good taste of what an RPG is, but it lasts like 8 hours. So, nice. And perhaps after my experience with Persona 3 and my 70 hours that went nowhere, that was refreshing.
Oh, they went somewhere.
So that was fun.
They went to the tower. So James is up next with some more new business.
Yeah, well, it's a repeat of last week's new business, but it's an update. So I have been absolutely pounding the ground out of Zero Escape, Virtue's Last Reward, for the last week. We're talking like I'm rattling off an ending every night, which is actually a tremendous amount of work because the game is so utterly abusive to you and sometimes. But what I mean, I don't really have much to update on gameplay because it's the same game I've been playing for the last 2 years at this point. But it really does. It has started to come together as coherent endings and watching the interplay between the different possible story paths. I really am near the very end of being able to get the final conclusion, which will be tremendously rewarding. They could totally screw me over with something ridiculous, but I don't feel like that's likely to happen. No, I'm really truly enjoying where this game's doing. And, I mean, it's hard for me, like I was last week. I thought about it since then. I was having difficulty determining who to suggest this game for. There's a certain subset of the population who obviously knows that they're good with this game. People who fondly remember what adventure games actually mean versus being titled action-adventure.
Sony accidentally left $40 in my PSN wallet. I'm not sure how that happened. But
it's like the Tooth Fairy? What happened?
Well, you know, there was a mix-up, and they refunded me, and then they were supposed to take some points out, and they didn't. So I've got 40 bucks sitting in there, and I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering if I liked Corpse Party, which I kind of did.
I've heard some people who played both say really seemed to enjoy both games. Mm-hmm. And make some favorable comparisons between the two. Again, I haven't played it, but this is just what I've heard from people who have. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'm 24 some change into the game at this point in 2 weeks. So,
wow.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's about 2.5 hours. About every night I can rattle off another ending at this point. But, you know, it takes a little while to get to that, to get there. I've crossed the point of feeling bad about consulting a guide on which path to take to get to another ending. It's just, there's 25 potential stopping points in the timeline, and only 9 of them have endings. So screw it. I'm not going to mess around. But no, I really think this is a really a good game on, I mean, I understand the Vita version is possibly better just in terms of its graphical stuff.
Well, yeah, that's what I would be getting it for. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard it
sounds cool.
It's tremendous on both platforms.
Do I need to have played 999? I think you mentioned before. But...
So there's some neat tie-ins if you have played it,
mm-hmm.
But the game itself actually gives you most of them through
cool.
these secret files. You can normally there's two solutions to the end puzzle in every room, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
All the rooms you get locked in, there's two solutions. The first one opens the door to let you out. It gives you some more story. The second one gives you the secret information, as they call it, the gold file. And that one, a lot of times, will give you tie-ins to the events from 999 that are relevant. Some of the characters who were involved in that game will also give you some background info, even in the normal course of gameplay. But if you have played the game, you do get to see some of the stuff before the game just spills the beans. And you go, wait, what's... And then you get to realize it for yourself versus it just being explicitly saying, this person they're talking about was in this game. They were the protagonist. They did, you know.
James, I have a technical question. I mean, Zero Escape is the 3DS sequel to a DS game.
Yes.
Do you feel like have they done anything with the new hardware, really? I mean, it's a text. It doesn't seem like 3D would really be used.
So the 3D is kind of weird. What they do is basically it's just three tiers. There's the text box, which is in the front. It's right up against the glass, as it were, and then there's the character art, and then there's the background. That's pretty much it. I mean, it's not great 3D effects, no. Sometimes the rooms can look okay in 3D. Because you pan around the room back and forth. But no, I mean, the 3D, I've played with the 3D off a bit, and in fact, some of the art looks kind of blurrier in 3D. So flipping it to 2D, it just looks crisper. It's also, you know, after 3 or so hours of trying to read the text in 3D, you just turn it down because it's just easier.
Yeah.
3D books. But then, I mean, I would guess that, you know, with this one having a lot of voice acting, maybe just the larger storage memory mm-hmm. would factor into it.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, that's the biggest change is that it's voice acted. It's doubly voice acted, so if you really hate the English voice actors, which you shouldn't, because they're actually pretty good, you can listen to it in Japanese, not understand a word they're saying. it is really well voice acted, actually. Not everybody, obviously, but, you know, it's a 10-person cast. They do pretty well. The characters that should be annoying are appropriately annoying, and sometimes... I've noticed in the past some people, when they discuss voice acting in shows, will get upset because a character is annoying when that character is supposed to be annoying. Sometimes that's just correct, and it feels like that in this game. There's nobody – I never want to just turn it down and go, I'll just read, thanks. I mean, you can put the game in auto mode where it just pages through while they're talking, and then I don't even read it unless your character's talking and he doesn't have a voice. They did the whole Quiet Link thing.
Hmm. I think in terms of voice acting, especially in video games, but animation as well, my main pet peeve is when someone sounds like a voice actor.
Yeah, and the only real character, I mean, there's a little bit of that, but I mean, the only real character that's doing that is deliberately hamming it up.
Yeah.
As part of their character, so it makes sense in that context.
And that's probably true to the way it's written in Japanese.
Oh, it is. I mean, yeah. In Japanese, the character sounds equally psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, okay, this is uncomfortable to be around.
All right, so Nathan's up next, and Nathan gave us a long list of things he's been playing lately, and one of them was Harvest Moon for 3DS, and I thought, I got to get some of that because none of us really plays Harvest Moon, not on any kind of regular basis. So it might be a while before we get another chance to hear about this, and frankly... I wasn't even sure that there was a Harvest Moon
on
3DS yet.
It's like the second one.
There's two.
Were they released at the same time? Was it like Blue and Red editions?
No, one came out 2 years ago. That was the one with the two villages. And then I can't remember what this one is.
Yeah, the Tale of Two Towns one is the one I got kicked out of the E3 booth when I loudly asked... yes. Sir, your company is charging more for the 3DS version, and yet it looks exactly like the DS version. Yes. What justifies this increase?
That and was they not asked comfortable. Me to leave.
Yeah,
that was the same event that was the PS3 version of the Rune Factory game.
Yep.
He's like, is the PS3 version around? Oh, this is it. Okay, I thought this was the Wii version.
Oof.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they had a bad E3.
they always have a bad E3.
I've never seen Natsume have a good E3, frankly.
Yeah, they added... So I was on a conference call for that game for some reason, and somebody just flat out asked, why would I buy the 3DS version?
Right.
So there was a silence, and then the PR app jumps in, well, it's in 3D. And then there was a little more silence, and we've got some Street Pass stuff.
You know what?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Look, that's a checklist answer, but on some level, especially like in the early days of 3DS, that's probably enough for a lot of people.
But the only answer was we've got some Street Pass stuff.
They weren't even
it sounds
sure
weird
what it
that
was.
They would be so ill prepared to deal with that question.
Well, and see, when I asked it, the PR rep asked me to leave because I technically didn't have an interview scheduled with him, and to his utter delight, I came back later in the day to my scheduled interview. That was fun.
Oh, and he was nice to you then.
But you know what? This Harvest Moon is good, and it's only for the 3DS.
No, wait. And okay, so you're talking about the second one.
Harvest Moon, A New Beginning. It's supposed to be kind of a resetting of the series. And, you know, I can't really tell you what's that different outside of there's a lot of customization, and it kind of goes for aping Animal Crossing.
That's funny, because Harvest Moon probably inspired Animal Crossing in the first place.
It did, yeah, but then the thing I never liked about Harvest Moon was the clock was always ticking, and you always have to make a strict deadline for just about everything you do, and you've got to manage your stamina and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, near the start of this game, I kind of forgot about all that as they gave you all this cool stuff to unlock. You're kind of bringing new people into the town, crafting new items, crafting new buildings, and getting a lot of stuff just thrown at you every other second. But then after a while, I kind of tired out and realized, well, this is the same Harvest Moon. I get up every day, I run around, I cut my crops, I water my crops, I push the cow out of the barn, I brush the cow, I milk the cow, I push the cow back in the barn. I run up, I give a flower or a rock. Actually, I think a rock is what the girl likes. I give her a rock every day, and she says, thank you for the rock. You know, in my mind,
I love you, Harvest.
It's really weird. If someone did that to me, that would not be pushing me on the path to marriage. That would be restraining order territory, but that's how you get a wife in Harvest Moon. You give a girl a rock or a log or whatever it is she likes every day.
It's and a metaphor for diamond envy.
Then you run around the wilderness, you pick things out of the logs, and you pick things up out of the dirt, and you make what you can out of it, you sell it, and you go to bed. And while it's exciting for a while you're unlocking a lot of stuff, after a while it's like, I'm playing this game on my way to work, and I'm working more than I probably will during the course of my workday. And it's just not... It's fun for a while. This one got me the most out of any other Harvest Moon. But yeah, after a while, you kind of there's not really a creative aspect like there is in Animal Crossing, and that kind of kills it for me.
Like the idea is that there's some kind of larger goal, like you're trying to modernize your farm, or you're trying to save up for this machine that will then automate a lot of the tasks that you are currently doing, and that will free you up to go do other things that are different.
And it takes so long to do that, you know?
Right, because I remember reviewing the one for GameCube, and I liked a lot of things about it, but it felt like I was putting a ton of time into it and making precious little progress towards these big goals that they were kind of holding out. And And I did the romance part of it, which I thought was kind of interesting. I mean, especially, you know, back in 2002, 2003,
yeah,
that was fairly unusual for a game with any kind of romantic element to get localized for the West. And so I'd never really played anything like that. I thought, well, this is kind of neat. It's very cute. It's very innocent. But you're kind of, you know, it's just kind of a social dating thing. And then you, you know, then you get married and then you have a cute little kid and he grows up or whatever. But once I kind of went through that cycle and I'm still trying to save up for the seed machine or whatever they call it,
yeah,
I was like, I just don't feel like I'm ever going to get there, you know?
So one thing that I had had hope for in the Rune Factory series was they had introduced essentially the ability to tame animals to do a lot of this work for you.
Right.
But it was hard to find the one that did what you needed it to do. Like if you wanted an animal that cut the grass for you every day, and B, they tended to suck at it. like they would just miss plants when they're supposed to water. Like, ah! I'll play games in this series and I'll pretty much have the same reaction. I'll get about three seasons in and be like, what am I doing?
Yeah. It says something about the game that essentially its core mechanic is you trying to reduce your time with the core mechanics. If you get what I mean.
It is really bizarre.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, very much like farming, you know, like real farming. But
at least at some point you do get there, right? I mean, unlike a game like Farmville where you only do something in order to do more of it. Like the goal is always, you know, farther and farther away.
Yeah, they're different degrees of Sisyphean, but ultimately they are very closely related, obviously. And I wonder if Harvest Moon can really continue to exist as a series, at least in the West, because I do feel like Farmville has probably soaked up a huge chunk of the audience like Harvest Moon.
They're still coming out every year.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have a core group of devoted fans who buy the game every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, Neil's wife.
They get their plushie and they're happy.
Yep.
Which it's fine. If you like it, you like it.
Harvest Moon is not a bad game. It's not a bad series at all.
No, it's not. I mean, I've got two, I think.
I have fun with it while I'm playing it. I grow tired of it after probably 6-7 hours of play, which really it's not that good for a full priced release.
What's funny though is that when Grand Bazaar came out, people that are like really diehard fans of the series were vitriolic against that game because it shook up some of the mechanics about running the economy. like so that they're a bit restrained in how much they can change it. I mean,
yeah.
On our own staff, Carly hated the Grand Bazaar mechanic because it meant, great, I have to wait till Sunday to sell turnips. I can't sell turnips on Tuesday because there's nobody to buy them. I mean, it was just stuff like that. They want the game to be the game.
I don't remember if this is something that the other Harvest Moons did, but you have a mailbox similar to that in Animal Crossing. And every other day, or every once in a while, you get letters that will, I think maybe it's every month, you get something that shames you. You know, it's like...
Shames you?
Shames you. It's like, you know, you got some plants planted, but really people call you the fish farmer. And it's like, well, okay, I guess that's a bad thing because I go fishing a lot. But the game tries to encourage you to go fishing, and then it shits on you for fishing. So, like, I thought this was a game about freedom. I'm making a ton of money fishing here, and no, you're gonna crap on me for engaging in one of the mechanics I happen to find interesting, as opposed to, you know, watering the fake plants. And yes, I'm fishing for fake fish, but I like it more. So who the hell are you?
The fake world needs more fake tomatoes. Get on
it. Yeah, and it's like, well, crap. And another thing that bugs me about this game, and this is kind of ludicrous, it's up to your character to fund, personally bankroll, all of the public town improvements. Like, how useless are these people?
It's like Alice Shrugged.
well, I mean, it is. But, I mean, it's the same thing that happens in Animal Crossing. I mean, nobody contributes a dime to the town fund except you.
Well, aren't you the mayor and can't you, like, levy taxes against the people? And
no, it's the Articles of the Confederacy there.
oh, Tom Nook prints his own money then. Great.
Oh, man. Oh, so, Nate, This week, actually just a couple days ago, there was a fun Twitter debate between Carl Castaneda and myself over whether Super Mario platformer could ever be on iOS and could it be good? And my assertion was that you can change a lot of things. You can do a lot of crazy stuff to Mario, but fundamental to that franchise and really to 2D platforming, in my opinion, is that when you push a physical button, the character jumps, and it happens immediately, and it happens reliably, and you feel that connection, and then the rest of the game really is built around doing that, and you can always depend on that. So that conversation, it was kind of fun to get into it with Carl, but that's really against the backdrop of Mutant Muds being released for iOS this week, and this is a game that to me would be even worse than Mario with touchscreen control. Yeah. So I really am curious to hear what you think about it.
Yeah, I was telling.
Yeah, I've played both versions of Mutant Muds, and I just reviewed the iPad version. And it's another one of those reviews where I kind of put it out into the world and then I curl into the fetal position as everyone throws tomatoes at me. But 2D platformers in general just don't work on the iPhone or the iPad, and for the reasons you said. You know, the digital D-pad is, you're constantly aware of it. It's not something physical where you can establish my thumb is here relative to the D-pad. It's, you know, your thumb's on a big plane of glass, and there's no reliable way to know. If I shift my thumb to the left, I'm going to go left, and it's the second the button goes down. Here, there's this big D-pad that they give you, and in the middle, there's a dead zone. So it doesn't even work for sliding your thumb back and forth, because I'll kind of twitch my thumb to the right, and I'll end up in the middle of the D-pad, which does nothing. But I don't have a physical way of knowing I'm in the middle of the D-pad until I'm impaled by a spike pit. So it's a good game, and, you know, it really speaks to the strength of the 3D in the game that I found some sections pretty hard to play without 3D.
Really?
Where it gets complicated, I had a really hard time telling the difference between which plane I was in. I jumped for a platform that I thought was in the same plane as me, and I've died. And I'm just so used to playing that game in 3D, and I don't know. I mean, obviously people played it in 2D on the 3DS, but the 3D really adds to that game. And overall, my conclusion was, yeah, this is still a great game, but you're gimped, you're crippled, you can't play it how it was actually meant to be played.
And, but you got it for a dollar.
Oh yeah, you got it for a dollar, and it's worth a dollar.
You know? I saw, it was Victor Lucas who tweeted to Jules Watcham that, oh, I like this even better on the iPad mini than on the 3DS. And why? I just was like, why?
That's because it's Victor Lucas.
I don't understand why.
Well, the price was one of the reasons he gave. And,
you're playing it on a $500 phone that you pay $100-something every month to own. I don't understand.
And Mutant Muds was, what, $8 to begin with? It's not like it was expensive on 3DS.
No.
This stuff burns me up. But, I mean, yeah, obviously, Nate, you are not biased against iOS games.
No, I write for an iPhone iPad website. I genuinely enjoy a lot of games on those platforms, but this is not the kind of game I typically like. There have been some that have done well, and you know what? They're not too reliant on precision. They're more puzzle platformers, and that's fine.
Yeah, or the only platformer that I've beaten on the on my iPhone was Ghouls and Ghosts, and that's because you can take a ton of hits, and they're extremely lenient with the platforming. You can jump. I think you have infinite lives, really, so you can just get through it that way.
So it's anti-Ghouls and Ghosts?
Absolutely, yeah. It's only
like
a name.
Fools.
It's not the same experience, and the device isn't catered towards that kind of play. It's just not, and people need to realize it. And it's one of the most frustrating things as someone that writes about these to have people come back at you and tell you, "No, this is a great game. You just, you know, down with the DS, screw the DS and the Vita. This is the pure version." It's like, "What the hell are you talking about? What the hell are you on? This is not the optimal experience." But I don't mean to shit on the game. The game is still fantastic, and it is playable. It's just far from optimal.
I wonder if one day we'll have like haptic screens that will fix this problem a little bit. So you could still have a flat surface, but when you move your finger over a certain portion of the screen, it would vibrate or tingle, or it would do something to kind of indicate to you that you're in the zone that you need to activate that.
But it would need to continually vibrate to remind you you're on.
You need a constant frame of reference, and that's something that a sheet of glass isn't going to do.
It would be utterly frustrating, I would imagine.
All right. So very quickly, Nathan, I know you've also been playing some Wii U stuff, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on Mario U, since that's been a very popular topic of the past few weeks.
Mario U and the Adventures of the Green Exclamation Point Box.
And it sounds like someone is calling you. It's super annoying.
It's been ticking my wife off to the point where I have to play on the gamepad because I suck so bad at this game. I don't know what happened. I can play through a lot of Super Mario 3 with my eyes closed. You know, I don't know. I like the game. I'm finding it too difficult. I don't know if I'm not being patient enough. I don't know if I didn't train myself properly.
Well, maybe if the screen were multi-touch, but then Nintendo gimped their hardware.
Shut up, Guillaume. There are good iOS games, okay? This would clearly be abysmal on an iPad. I don't know what it is. I like the game. I think it's really cool. But I got stuck on the castle at the end of the desert. I think I finally pushed past that. It may have just been that level for me. Something about it didn't click. Something about the platforms moving in the opposite direction of me moving and trying to grok how I need to jump. Mm-hmm. And probably the fact that I'm also speaking to my wife and something's going on the TV. Maybe I just need to concentrate and play the game.
May not be the optimal setting. Is that the level with the giant green snake block that you have to stay on? Because
I'm guessing what you're talking about is an actual difficult level. I'm talking about the the one where you fight the I don't know the name of anything in Mario. It's one of the Koopas where he hits the pieces of the caterpillar at you. It's super early in the game. It's at the end of the second world.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has a kind of a pattern. He telegraphs where he's going to throw those things but it's a short time frame you have to move.
I was fine with the boss. It's, I guess, from what I've heard people describe of how to make yourself have lucid dreams is you don't want to get too excited when you realize you're dreaming. I realize I've gotten to the boss, I've gotten past the difficult parts for me, and I just freak out and I died.
I know that feeling. Oh yeah.
It sounds an awful lot like the two really difficult level packs in New Super Mario Bros. 2 where it's like, alright, got past it and oh fuck.
No, but see, it's not hard. It's not actually hard. That's my point. I just suck at this. It's okay.
Well, you know, we've talked before about how especially in this one, it is kind of more like Mario 3 in that pretty much every level has some different mechanic that you maybe haven't seen before. And
which
so
I like.
I don't think there's any shame in getting stuck or having a lot of trouble early in the game because it may just be that, you know, that level has the mechanics that you have more trouble with. And then the next five worlds that you go through will all be fine. And I think it's the kind of game where different people will get stuck or slow down in different parts of the game just because there's so much variety.
Well, and it lets you wean yourself on the pink baby Yoshi, which I didn't lose the pink baby Yoshi until I got to that level. And that kind of makes the game super easy. It turns into Kirby.
Oh, wow. I think I lost that on the same level that I got him.
No, I kept that. And I'm thinking that's why all of a sudden I get to this level and it's like, what's going on?
Wait, I have to.
I've been playing Kirby the whole time. Yeah.
Oh, well, go get a squirrel suit, or you could always go back to where you got the baby Yoshi and just get him again, and then just, you know, skip through the map all the way up to where you're stuck.
Yeah, well, I beat the level. I'm not stuck anymore, thank God.
Okay.
So that's all I have to say about it. It's a great game that I just am terrible at.
Unfortunately, I haven't had time to play it the past week. I played some Assassin's Creed, and that was good. I made some progress. I'm actually playing as the main character, and he's all grown up and fully trained and has his costume and everything. So it feels like now I'm in the main act of the game. I'm through all the, and there's a lot of build up to that, but that's part of the fun. I mean, it makes it more satisfying once you are finally playing as the awesome badass, half Native American, Connor. It's a cool game so far, and the naval battles are fucking rad. Whoa. They look amazing, and they're really fun to play. They make the ship easy to control, but also feel realistic, which I was really surprised that they struck that balance.
Because, when I saw the trailer for that, those ships were going really fast.
They can go fast. I mean, you control how much of the sail, so you can close the sail all the way, at which point you barely move it all forward, or you can open them halfway or all the way. And it not only changes the speed, but also the amount of control you have over the steering. So there's a trade-off there. And then once you start battling, you're trying to steer and aim the guns and control the speed all at the same time. And you really have to balance all that stuff. And the battling is, in terms of the way it all plays out, it's similar to like the ship battles in Skies of Arcadia, except it's in real time, except it's an action game. But you're still trying to do these broadside sweeps. And these flanking maneuvers and stuff, and you have different kinds of guns. It's really cool. Really awesome. So I'm liking that, but I haven't played a ton more of it.
Can you destroy parts of the ship? I'm sorry. I'm super curious about this. Can you knock down one of their masts or anything like that?
I'm not sure yet. I've only done sort of the intro to the ship stuff, and you can go back and do more ship missions sort of whenever you want to. But I just unlocked that ability. And it wasn't really clear to me. There is a kind of cannon you can use that you can aim at specific, it's a smaller cannon, but it's like free aiming, and you can aim it on certain parts of the ship. And one of the practice ships they give you, has some explosive barrels. So if you manage to see that from far off, you can train the smaller cannons on that and blow up the whole thing in one shot if you really get a really lucky shot. But I don't know if they take localized damage or not. I'm not sure about that. But when your ship blasts off the main cannons, it feels like, whoa, I just unloaded on this guy. And when the ships go down, it looks awesome. That is some really cool shit in a game that I wouldn't have expected that kind of element to work so well and to be so fun and satisfying. It feels like they could have made a whole game out of this problem.
I may have to get that cool and just sit there sailing, and maybe I could sit in the bathtub with some toy boats and play it. It's the Wii U.
But just keep in mind, it'll take a few hours before you even get to that part of the game.
Oh, so I'll wait on getting in the bath.
Yeah, you'll be really shriveled up by that time. So the games that I've been playing, the new games that I've been playing this week, I got a couple. They're both music games, actually. First one is Rocksmith. And this is—it's not even really a game, I guess. It's Ubisoft sort of guitar training software that they put out last year, and the new version is out now. It's got guitar and bass, and so the original version that's only guitar has been discounted deeply. And so I got it from Amazon for like $30, and that's including the cable that you plug into your guitar. So this is, we had sort of dabbled with this when we were at PAX East last year, and got to try Neil's Rock Band 3 Fender guitar, the crazy thing that has like all the sensors built into the frets, and it's a real guitar, but it's also a Rock Band controller. And Rocksmith takes a much more practical approach to that, which is to say this works with any guitar. And we just read the frequencies coming through the output jack, and it works really well, like really well, kind of shockingly. Now, it is very sensitive to lag in your HDTV, so I fiddled with some settings and got it to be a little bit better. It was playable right off the bat, but I run my sound through HDMI, which they strongly recommend against. but there's just not a very good alternate solution for me and with my TV setup. So I fiddle with some settings in the TV and try to turn off some things, and I think it helped. But it's responsive enough, and the cool thing is you don't have to mute the strings or anything like that. I mean, when you're playing an electric guitar, so it's the thing that always happens with when you're playing an electric. You hear the sound that comes out of the amp that's all distorted and it's run through effects or whatever. In this case, it's coming out of the game, but they will apply effects for you that are appropriate to the song. But you also hear the sound of the actual strings. And so this goes back to a criticism that TYP often has against music games, which is that in a lot of music games, when you play the wrong note, it doesn't actually play the note that you played. It just plays this kind of generic. And I think he has a very strong point in that is counter to what your ears need to hear. Your ears need to hear the wrong note so that they know what not to do. Otherwise, you don't make the connection between what your fingers are doing and what your ears actually pick up. And the great thing about this is that when you play the wrong note, the game can't fake it because you actually hear the note that you played on the real string, and you hear it through the game because they reproduce it faithfully. And so you get that feedback that you need to say, oh no, I did something wrong. And that's when you look down and say, oh, my finger wasn't far enough over. I know how to correct it now. So that's really good. And the interface was my biggest question because I hadn't really watched videos of this. I wasn't really clear on how they handle this. You know, you've got a guitar with like 24 frets or so on it. It's a really big platform with a lot of different places, just hundreds of places where you could put your fingers. And you've got all these different techniques like sliding and bending and hammer on and pull off. And a lot of these aren't in Guitar Hero or Rock Band because those games don't actually have real strings, and so you could never do that stuff.
It'll know if you've done a hammer-on?
Yes.
Wow. I might have to go get this.
It knows because the volume decays. So if you had fretted the new note and plucked the string, the volume would go back up to whatever the typical plucking volume is. But with a hammer-on, you change the frequency because you move to a new fret, but you haven't replucked the string, so the sound just continues to get lower. The volume continues to get lower. And so it knows how to discriminate that. It's very smart. I will say that, you know, the game's difficulty is adaptive. So they're monitoring how you do, and they will ramp up the introduction of new techniques or the number of notes they ask you to play within the song based on how you're doing. And they do this during the song, which is a little disconcerting sometimes because it'll feel like you're really getting a handle. You've done this riff, you know, 10 or 12 times, and you really have got the muscle memory down, and you can do it very consistently. And then they add a new note to it, and you're like, oh shit. And it just throws you off, you know? And so I'm not crazy about the way that they do that, but I am glad that they don't make you select all that stuff up front, because then they're asking you to sort of self-evaluate your skills, and you may not even understand enough about guitar to even do that. So it's good. I mean, they just start everybody at the same place, and within a couple of songs, they figured out what you can and cannot do pretty well. And they adapt to it. At the same time, they are pretty aggressive about throwing in new techniques. And in fact, the funny thing is they'll throw in stuff like bending or a slide or palm muting. They'll throw that into a song, and then after the song is over, explain to you what it is. So you kind of have to guess sometimes. But that only happens once, of course. Once they introduce it, then it's out there, and then you know that it could come up. But it's a little shocking when it first happens. And the other scary thing is that they never slow down the songs just because you messed up. So they will let you mess up all you want to, but the song never slows down. So the notes are going to keep coming, and they can filter out a lot of the notes and ask you to only play one or two little pieces of this certain riff, but they can't slow down how fast those notes come down the pipe. So you're playing guitar at the speed of the song, and that's intimidating at first. It's like, oh shit. I mean, Guitar Hero and Rock Band get away with this a little bit. They have certain things that they can do. But it's also just the fact that you're playing on a real instrument. It's just naturally more intimidating, you know, and it's more physical. I mean, the very first night I played it, my fingers were hurting the next day. They're still hurting now. My thumb is sore from plucking the strings because I don't have a pick yet. I got to go get those this weekend. it's the real deal. And the nice thing is that when you play a riff and you practice it and you play through that song a couple of times, you can literally turn the game off and just keep doing the same thing. Because they're teaching, they're not fudging the positions or anything like that. They can't, because you can hear what you're doing. Very cool. I mean, it's kind of exactly what I wanted. And you're playing, you know, mostly pretty interesting songs. So it's not like you're playing Mary Had a Little Lamb over and over again. Really cool. Really cool. The other music game that I played this week is Theatrhythm Final Fantasy. I got this a couple weeks ago, actually, over Black Friday, because Amazon had it for $20, and I thought, well, I kind of wanted to get it earlier. I just never really had the time or the bandwidth to commit to it. But over the summer, you know, a lot of guys on staff were really talking up this game, and we heard from some people who played it for 60 hours or something like that. Jeez, that's insane for a rhythm game. So for $20, I was more than happy to snap on it. And I'm really enjoying it so far, and it turns out to be really good timing, because this game just came out on iOS this week. Funny enough, the deal I got for $20 for the 3DS version is actually considerably cheaper than the iOS version.
$150.
To get all the songs?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of DLC songs, and I'm sure if you bought all the DLC for 3DS, it would cost you, you know, somewhere in that range as well.
No, fun fact. If you bought all the DLC for the 3DS version, not only do you get more songs, because not all the songs are available for purchase on the iOS version, so it's not even comparable, it's $80.
Only 80? Really?
Only 80, and that's including the price of the game, and you know, which you paid less for, and then iOS is 150.
Yeah, but you know, I was just looking at it earlier. I mean, the actual app on iOS is free. The platform is free.
Yeah, but I'm guessing it's basically the same as the demo. The free demo that was released for the 3DS.
Probably so. And then you buy the packs of songs. And mm-hmm. So the good thing is, you know, the 3DS game comes with, there's three songs, really four or five songs each for Final Fantasy 1 through 13. That's the base package. And there's a lot of Dark Note stuff that you have to unlock. But the Final Fantasy 1 through 13, you can access them immediately. They're all there. You just choose whichever ones you want. Look, let's face it. Most people probably haven't played all 13 of those. And even if they have, they may not care to have the music from all 13 of them.
You're right.
The good thing is, on iOS, I think you could just kind of choose. So if you only cared about Final Fantasy 1, 4, and 6, you could go pick that up and only pay about $10.
Yeah, that's
and have
point.
All that stuff. So it's more flexible that way, but you know, certainly eventually you would pay the price if you downloaded enough songs. Either way, I think the game's really good. And as I was playing it on 3DS, I was not at all surprised that they would eventually put it on iOS, because it's single input. It doesn't feel like an iOS game in a derogatory way that some people might say that. You know, but the interface is very simple. It feels like a game that would map to that platform quite well. And it reminded me a lot of Groove Coaster, which you've probably played, Nate. Mm-hmm. It's a very simple rhythm game that came out a few years ago on iOS. It has a lot of video gamey music in it. I don't really like Groove Coaster that much. It's a little too simple for my taste, and mm-hmm. it never really pulled me in. Whereas Theatrhythm just has a much better presentation, and it's more music that I'm more familiar with and have a lot of affection for from my childhood and more recently as well. And you know, these are all mostly Nobuo Uematsu songs, and they're just really good. The music's just fantastic throughout, even in the Final Fantasy games you haven't played.
I think the talk on Twitter about, like, oh, I've played this game for 70 hours now kind of turned me off, because it does seem a little bit grindy, no?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say no. I mean, you can. I mean, obviously, you can play through the 13 games and the set of songs for each one in much less time than 70 hours. And then, you know, you can go in the Dark Note stuff and spend as long as you want on that stuff. But I think people are playing it for that long because they're just addicted to it. They're playing the same stuff over and over again. Hmm. But grinding implies that you're trying to level up your characters in order to do some greater goal at the end that's kind of locked until you spend enough time. And the structure of this game is, I mean, you're picking sets of songs from a menu. I don't know what you could be grinding towards. So that doesn't really make sense to me. You know, you can you can level up your characters indefinitely, I'm sure. And that is fun, and it's nice to see that kind of progression, you know, as you, the more you play, your characters get up, they learn little abilities, magic spells that very subtly affect the outcome of playing the songs. You know, they give you more points, or they, you know, they protect you from certain kinds of failures if you miss too many notes or whatever. But it's really not very important. It's mostly kind of optional stuff. And the game is very simple. The other thing it reminded me of actually is Donkey Konga, in the sense that the inputs are really simple. There's only, you know, one or two, maybe three or four different things you could possibly do. And it's all really about the rhythm and the sequencing. You know, sometimes the songs are really fast and you just have to be able to do this stuff very quickly. It's not that anything you're doing on the touchscreen is very complicated. You just have to be able to decipher the symbols as they come by on the screen and react to them quickly enough to keep up with it. And it's fun. You know, it's not very deep. It's not very complicated, but it's really fun. And the music's great. The graphics are really nice. The sort of RPG sauce that they poured over all of this is very novel for a rhythm game. And I'm really enjoying it so far. Really enjoying it. And I got it for a great price. So I'm pretty happy about it. I think if you're looking for a 3DS game that, you know, I mean, it's not Elite Beat Agents, you know. It doesn't tell that kind of story. It doesn't have as challenging of a mechanic in terms of what you do on the touchscreen. But I also think there's something very nice, and this might be another advantage over the iPhone version. It's really nice to have two screens in this case, because you play entirely on the touch screen, even though you're always looking at the top screen. And the great thing about the way they've done the touch screen here is that it doesn't matter where you touch. So you can touch anywhere. You never have to look at the touch screen. You can always focus on the top screen, and that means that your stylus or your finger is never covering up part of the play area. So I think being able to separate the input from the display in this case is a nice advantage for this version of it. And you know, I think that would be not a huge problem on iOS, but it could get annoying. It's been annoying for me on Groove Coaster and other games on iOS, so I could see how that would be a problem. But yeah, it's really good. Not surprising, considering all the praise that it got, but I'm enjoying it quite a bit. And that's going to wrap up new business, so we're going to take a break, do some now playing, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a review for Crimson Shroud by Guillaume Veillette.
Hey.
Roll Dem Dice. It's a tabletop RPG simulator from the creator of Ogre Battle, only in Japan. And we have a blog called You Make Me Feel Like Pants, a love letter to Kirby's Epic Yarn by Neil Ronahan. 2 years ago, Neil gave Epic Yarn a 10 out of 10. Seriously, go check it. 2 years on, he's penned a spirited defense of his review in celebration of Kirby's anniversary.
He seems befuddled that he got heat for giving that game a 10 out of 10. We also have a feature this week. Top 10 3DS eShop games. It's list time, and this time it's a list of the top 10 eShop games. Note, this list only includes games released up to now on account of none of us being T-1000 sent back to the past to review eShop games. We also have a blog, The Kirby Medal Has Arrived by Zach Kaplan. There's a Club Nintendo Kirby medal in Zach's house. It's a medal. He took pictures of it. Go look.
Was this a special prize? Is this just something you can buy with points?
I believe it was something you bought with points. It was a...
Sounds expensive. It's made of actual metal.
Yeah, I think it was 1,000 points or something ridiculous.
Ooh.
We also have a review of Smart Girl Playhouse Mini on the DS by Philip Stortzum. Yes, this is a game, and yes, we reviewed it, but with activities including drawing, counting, find differences, lunchbox, dress-up, and coloring, how could we not? Also, that's all of the activities in the game.
We have a blog, The Legend of Zelda Skyward Swag by Andrew Brown. In the past, we've noted that Andrew's ability to collect Nintendo swag is legendary. This time, he's procured a Japanese figurine of Link, based on his Skyward Sword model. Pictures of Link shrugging at his 500th Collect Doodad quest included. We have another blog, Monster Hunter Wii U in the House, by Danny Bivens. Wii U is finally out in Japan, and Danny bought the Monster Hunter Bundle, also known as the Standard Edition in Japan. Pictures of Black Label adult games included.
Ooh.
Yeah, and to finish off, we had the feature, Kirby Video Retrospective. The Nintendo World Report is presenting videos from our friends at Third Rate Minion that delve into the 20-year history of Sakurai's pink placeholder.
That's a very dismissive way to refer to Kirby.
It's what he was!
Very nice. Well, you can check out all of this great original content, plus all the latest news, even more reviews, eShop updates, everything you could possibly want to know about the world of Nintendo is over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It's time for listener mail, and as always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I also asked some people for questions and topics for the show over Facebook and Twitter this week, and thanks to those of you who responded, hopefully we'll get to some of those. So Guillaume has the first letter this week.
Yes, the Fleece writes, I recently asked my gamer friends if they knew about the Ouya, and they didn't even know what it was. When I explained it as a console that runs on Android with free-to-play games, they became interested. At $99, it seems like a steal to me. What do you think of the upcoming release of the Ouya next year? What kind of games would you expect to play on this new system? With the Wii U fresh out of the gate and other consoles emerging, how will this new console fare with gamers' time and the gaming market?
So this is, it's good that we have Nate on here for this one, because I bet he's going to have a little bit different opinion than the rest of us. But I think that Ouya is interesting. And this was the Android-based mini console that was kickstarted earlier this year. It's supposed to be coming out in January or February, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a cool idea. And there clearly was a demand for something like this. But I think a lot of people who paid for the Kickstarter and are getting these early consoles that they're putting out are kind of just more curious than anything. I don't know that they expect it's going to fill some kind of gap in the gaming market. I think they're just kind of want to see it happen, you know, and see what comes out of it. But my feeling is, if you know, you think about the games that are developed for Android, they are primarily phone games. Mm-hmm. There are some Android tablets, but certainly most Android software is built for phones, and you can run phone software on a console, and you know, some of those games might be fine as console experiences, but they're designed for touchscreen interfaces, and the Ouya does not have a touchscreen. It has a controller, and I think it's going to be very difficult for them to get developers to sign on for redeveloping their games to support physical controls. And even then, I wonder how many of those developers actually have experience doing so, and whether they're going to do a good job of it.
Yeah, but then you have some developers like Renegade Kid, who, like, I know that Jules Watcham was kind of excited. I think he contributed to the Kickstarter to get his development kit. And so, you can expect Mutant Muds to show up on there. And that's kind of a funny situation where the game started out with physical controls, so I don't think he's going to have any problems with the porting process.
Sure. Right.
But I'm not really aware of the other developers, but I do know that one of the main rewards for the Kickstarter was a development kit for these indie developers. So, like, we probably have already a good list somewhere of the developers that we expect to see on there.
Yeah, well, there's already a great console for indie developers. It's called
PC. Called the PC. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking for a relatively inexpensive platform that you could use a controller with, or, you know, any other number of control inputs, mouse and keyboard. And, yeah, you don't have to get a PC that plays the latest and greatest games.
Right. But PC developers, I don't think they want to use Android as a development platform.
No.
So there's a weird gap here. I think there will be games for it. I don't know what they're going to look like. I don't know what they're going to be. I don't know who they're appealing to. And it's a strange place, you know, but I'm glad that they're doing something different. I'm certainly look forward to it. And I don't want one, you know. But if I wanted to play Android or iOS games, I could do that, and I rarely do because I'm not really interested in most of the stuff that comes out on those platforms. And in general, adding a controller is not going to fix the problems that I have with games that are developed on that platforms. It's more that the market that they're trying to appeal to that I don't fit. And so will Ouya have its own audience that developers will try to cater to that in a different way than they do for other places? I don't know. I think it's going to be a lot of kind of port dumping, you know, especially with Android. And I just wonder how many of those games are really going to fit well on what Ouya does. You know, when you blow it up on a TV screen and put a controller in your hand, I don't know that a lot of those games make sense anymore.
I think it's going to breathe new life into Cannibalt.
Yeah. I just got an Android phone as part of my quest to obtain all gadgets known to man. And it's, out of all the games I've played on it, which are mostly roguelikes, there's not a single one that I said, but I wish this was on my TV with a controller. Mm-hmm. They're not designed for that. So the whole idea of having an instant library filled with games, it's just not there. I don't see the potential to convert a lot of these games, and the ones that I can, I don't think they already support it. So,
no, right. I mean, it would almost, if they had built some kind of touchscreen into the system, then at least it would be the console for all of your angriest birds.
Well, I mean, yeah, if they made it a gamepad, you know, Wii U gamepad, but it's not.
Then it wouldn't cost $99.
Exactly.
There's sort of rock in a hard place. I mean, a lot of these games are going to need to be redeveloped at the very least.
Right.
Yeah. You're getting a smaller selection in what is already a sparse gaming landscape.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly possible there will be Ouya exclusives that are designed for that platform.
Sure. But they're not going to be big. I mean, because the Ouya's
they'll be primarily independent games, which is cool, but again, that market kind of already exists with the PC, especially what the PC is turning into in the past couple of years. So, you know, certainly $99 is a lot cheaper than any kind of gaming PC that you could go out and buy.
Sure.
But it's not going to have nearly the kind of selection that PC does. And I just wonder how many developers are really going to put the effort into making something exclusively for Ouya or just making an Ouya version that's really, you know, designed for that platform.
Yeah, I think you'd get more out of
it. It's going to be interesting to find out how it pans out, you know.
You'd probably get more oomph out of even a gaming, like a used netbook or something. You could probably get closer to that price, and you could play games like To the Moon on it.
Sure.
You might get someone's credit card details.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, like, hypothetical situation, if the Ouya were to take off and somehow become actually, more than a viable platform, like even a popular one, would it put pressure on Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft to perhaps be more friendly to indie developers, to lower their fees, or to not make them pay $40,000 for patches, or et cetera?
It would put pressure on my sanity. Because, I mean, it just wouldn't make sense. I mean, it just seems so far from
reality. Well, but that's ignoring Guillaume's argument. It's,
yeah, I know. I mean, but
it's a hypothetical.
Yeah, do we think it would
happen?
It's
tough because, you know, companies like Nintendo, I mean, just on a licensing platform, they can't compete with Ouya. Ouya is going to be essentially, I think the games will be licensed, but they'll be like, they're promising like extremely low license fees. And the OS is free. It's open source.
Right.
The development kits are practically free. You know, they're extremely cheap. And so I think it would be very hard for a company like Nintendo or Sony to compete with Ouya if the platform itself was huge and there was a massive audience. I think it might push them to lower their licensing fees or to lower the barriers of entry for independent developers, but I just think that's really unlikely.
I mean, I, yeah. just out of curiosity, I pulled up the top free games on my Android phone. In the first 50, there are 5 different iterations of Angry Birds, 2 iterations of Fruit Ninja, an iteration or 2 Zynga games that are basically ripoffs of existing puzzle games, and 2 solitaires. It's like,
Well, and let me just throw this out there, but, you know, iOS and Android phone have a similar situation. I think with Ouya, the developers who put those games out there are going to be hoping to sell these games, right? But I mean, yep. On Android in particular, there's a culture of people who don't like to actually pay for things on Android. There's a lot of piracy. There's a lot of copycat games. And you know, mobile game developers don't really like to release things on Android a lot of time because they don't really see the return on investment. You take that now to a console, and if people are buying this in the hopes that they will pay $99 for it, never have to spend another dime and get a bunch of free games, then that's not a very good environment for developers. And then if it turns into, well, everything's microtransaction to hell and back, then you're just going to hear all the same grumbling that you already do. So,
and I think the grumbling in that's gotten louder in the last year or so. I mean, sure,
yeah, thankfully,
it dilutes the game experience.
A lot of reviews I put out, I severely criticize microtransactions, and they're in a lot of iOS games, even ones that you pay for. You know, yeah. you pay like $10+ for a Square Enix iOS game, and you're nickel and dime for your time, which is crazy.
Yeah, there was, I can't remember what game it was, but Wired did the article where he managed to get the top score on it because he just spent $26.
Yeah.
Like, he basically bought the top score in the game.
Yeah, well, and then there's the whole risk of moving the Japanese RPG model to a microtransaction system to where traditionally in those games... You know, it's an exchange between the player's time for grinding out levels and, you know, their progress in the game, which is normally on the up and up because it's just between the player and the game, but now it's between the player and their wallet, and you're making that choice. Do I grind or do I pay? It's stupid.
Very scary.
Yeah.
You know, and then the other thing is, you know, you can say a lot about WiiWare, eShop, PSN, but... Those are viable markets to release a game, you know, spend 2 years working on your little very small team game, whether mm-hmm. it's an independent group or maybe you're, you know, kind of a segment of a larger studio that have been sort of given this side project. You see this with, you know, stuff like Shadow Complex. It's very viable place to release a game for $10 or $15 and for people to feel like that's an acceptable price because that's the standard. Ouya is the Wild West, and mm-hmm. there are advantages and there are negatives to going with that model, you know. And if it's a place where you release a game for $5 or $10, and then everybody bitches and moans about how expensive it is, then it's going to be very hard to convince people to actually put effort into making, you know, really quality, in-depth, larger games for that platform. And this is something that phones have a lot of trouble with, but I think there are different expectations for a kind of game that you're going to get on your phone. With people have an entirely different set of expectations for what a console game should be. And, you know, even if it runs on Android. So it's fascinating, really. And it's certainly, it's not all bad. I'm very curious to see what happens, but, I don't think it's an assured success regardless of how much they raised on Kickstarter. And I think just because it runs on Android and it's cheap does not necessarily mean this is going to be a success in terms of the kind of games that are available for it. Well, James is going to read the next letter.
Wilson 108 writes, I was wondering if I could have any of your Nintendo Network IDs for Wii U. I have always wanted to play online with people from NWR, but it's very difficult to do so up until now.
Okay.
It's still difficult.
Yeah. I think the best way to resolve this might be to put them in the article, but I would say that our forums are actually a really, really good place to find people to play with.
Yeah, isn't there a thread?
There is an entire forum about friend codes and other bullshittery that Nintendo has put out.
Yeah, I need to go there.
Yeah, I need to put mine in there. We've got an internal staff list that we've been keeping. We're not going to give all those out, but I certainly don't mind. I've had lots of RFN listeners add me on Nintendo Network, and I'm very happy to keep adding those people on there. I will say, I mean, there's a hard limit of 100 people, and I'm not there yet, but I'm getting close. At some point, when I fill up, I will start to replace people with when I get requests from people I actually know and have met in real life. I will start to bump off people if they're just kind of random acquaintances. But until then, you know, I'm happy to accept anybody. My ID on there is Johnny NWR. So feel free to add me, and I'll be happy to do that. I haven't played much online yet, but if I do, it should be easy to find a game with 100 people on my friends list. I have to turn off that light on the gamepad that lights up, because there's just way too many people, and it just kind of blinks constantly.
But then you won't know when I'm calling you in the Wii U chat.
Yeah, and they really need to update that with a separate setting. Really need to.
I, you know, between the Negative World people and the people who found me, who figured out that my Pandarius name on the boards and the Nintendo World Report boards would be my name on the Miiverse, I've already filled up my 100 people list.
Wow.
Really? Already?
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. For the past week, I guess. So I'm sorry. And
everybody wants those handwritten poutine drawings.
Well, I'm a terrible artist. So, like, you don't even get the, you know, you can't even take solace in the fact that you can follow me because I'm boring on the Miiverse.
Well, but you bring up a good point, Guillaume, because even if our friend lists are full, you can always look us up and follow us. So there's really no harm in us giving our names out there, because you can, you know, then you can see whatever we post. And I can't imagine any of us have a problem with that. I mean, it's Miiverse.
If you send me, like, some people already sent me requests that I had to deny. So, I'm sorry to those people, but I did follow them, and I will follow you if, you know, you say, hey, I'm a listener from, I listen to RFN, then, you know, I'll try to keep track. What I'm probably not going to do, because it seems like way too much of a hassle, is try to weed out the people who don't play online games, or, you know, and try to replace them with people who do, because that sounds like a lot of work, and there's no easy way on the Miiverse to know exactly what a person regularly plays online.
Right.
So I find the whole limit unfortunate. It seems a little bit arbitrary to me. Like, I don't see why you would have to be limited to 100 people.
It's database control.
Well, maybe, but I mean, if you can follow 1,000 people, like, what's the difference, really?
You know. Well, the difference is that the API that Nintendo gives to developers to implement online gameplay, you know, and access that friends list has a certain, you know, I mean, they, in other words, they don't want to ask developers to have to show a list of 3,000 people who you're friends with for you. So it simplifies the matchmaking systems in the games to some extent, which is not to say that number could never go up. But I think, you know, as we've seen in the case of Xbox Live, which is still capped at 100 people 10 years later, it's probably not as trivial to change as you might think.
Hmm.
Because this is integrated. It's not just at the system level. This is integrated into the games. And so you have to make sure that whatever the new limit is backwards compatible with the old way. And then how do you decide how to choose a subset of your 1,000 friends so that the list is compatible with this old game that only supports up to 100 people. It's tricky, you know.
I don't mind giving out my Wii name. What's it called? I'm Greybrick, Greybrick. Please do not add me if you're the guy commenting on my Grand Theft Auto Vice City review.
And James, do you know yours off the top of your head?
It is the letter Z before my forum name, so it is Zcrim. Which is
with 2 M's.
Because I couldn't do a 5-character name for some reason. So I'm like, well, this is what I had to use in the past when it was taken, so fuck it.
But they don't have to filter out all the people who want to name themselves God or Jesus or Satan or Obama.
But I'm kind of impressed that people managed to find me from the forums. They must have put effort into it. Like,
well, maybe they found me first and then friended you through my friends
can,
list.
Can they hop like
right,
that?
Right, you can look at other people's friends lists and then find all the famous people that they know.
There you go.
Famous.
Yeah. So I'm limiting my minimum acceptance rate to, let's say, Jeremy Parrish fame and above. So this is an exclusive club. Or I'll just accept you if you send an invite. I don't know. One or the other.
Well, so yeah. So I'll see about putting these in the show notes for the thread as well, and I'll try to link to the thread with the community Nintendo Network IDs, because I think it's easy enough now that we don't have to do friend codes anymore. It's easy enough to add people that you should go ahead and fill up your list as much as possible, because then you have more choices and you have more things to look at on Miiverse. Your activity list will be filled up very quickly, and you'll have more fun with the system. So don't sit around and wait for people to magically discover you. Go to the site, add a bunch of people, put your name on there, and other people will add you, and that's how this is supposed to work. So we'll hook you up, man. Don't worry about it.
I like the idea of waiting to be discovered.
So Nathan actually has the next email.
Adolf Vega writes, in the last episode of RFN, you talked about Pikmin 3 and the challenges to make it more different and interesting than its predecessors. I have a few ideas to make things more interesting. Please discuss. Entire game is co-op with gamepad as second player or second Wiimote/nunchuck. Dynamic level design that changes and adapts to gameplay. He gives some specifics here. Mudslides caused by animals, flash floods, so areas could become pools instantly, and wildfires. Draw lines for Pikmin to follow, either by pointing or touchscreen. Ability to use objects and environment better, so Pikmin can toss rocks. Use small killed creatures to bait bigger ones.
I love that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Adolf actually added he had a list of like 10 different things, and I trimmed it down for the sake of time. These were some of the ones I thought were probably the most interesting and maybe the most likely. I mean, co-op with a second person on the gamepad seems like is very much possible. I think that would be very cool. Because
do you need to have a representative of Nintendo at your home to tell you, to advise you not to play it on the gamepad?
Oh, that's a little inside probably, but I think now that that's been shown in some other games, it seems like such a good idea. And I'm sure, you know, Pikmin 2 had co-op, split screen, which is tough. And I think split screen is not great for Pikmin, partly because the Pikmin themselves are already pretty small on the screen. And then if you take up half of it and you zoom the camera out so you can actually see enough of the field to play the game, all of a sudden the visual fidelity goes way down. Even in HD, it's just going to be hard to see what's going on. So being able to separate those screens out and have one person on the TV, one on the gamepad, sounds like a really good solution. And you know, I'm still hoping for online co-op. I know that's a pipe dream with Nintendo, but Pikmin is a game I generally don't care that much about co-op. I think it's more trouble than it's worth to actually find someone to play with you and, you know, to try to sync up where you are in the story, you know, or one person has to go back and play stuff they've already played just because they're farther along and you're joining the other person's game. There's a bunch of infrastructure shit that I hate about playing online, and I think co-op is even worse in some cases because it's a more persistent experience. But Pikmin, you know, is a game I really like, and because it's a strategy game, playing cooperatively totally changes how you play the game. It totally fundamentally changes the gameplay and the difficulty curve. I think it would be really cool to play that online. But even, you know, locally, I would imagine that the co-op was not played by very many people in Pikmin 2.
You know, I played a ton of the adversarial multiplayer, and I think it would be fantastic as a two gamepad game where it's true hidden information between two parties. That would actually be very fun.
It's probably coming out too early for that feature.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I don't think it'll happen, but
yeah. It would be neat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see some fun stuff, you know, with if you were competing and both of you, you know, the goal, basically the destination or the objective was on the TV screen, and you couldn't necessarily see what the other person was doing. You're both on your game pads, kind of managing your Pikmin and doing stuff like that. It'd be kind of cool.
I just, there's really a reason why I'm not a game designer, and I have no imagination for this sort of thing. I'm just trying to picture kind of new gameplay for Pikmin 3, and I'm just thinking, like, why not get back to the RTS roots and build some barracks and put them in there?
Tower defense.
Bunkers.
Well, you know, the idea of building nodes in a Pikmin map would be good because it would give you a good way to cycle through the map quickly without... I mean, I guess now you have the gamepad that you could tap on. But that would be kind of fun for a multiplayer situation again.
I tell you, what I would really like is some way to move what do they call it? The base, you know, where the Pikmin live.
Right.
Whatever that thing's called. It's always mm-hmm. next to your spaceship.
Yeah.
To be able to move that or to build another one deeper in the level. Because one thing I really hate about Pikmin is you get really deep in the level, you find some awesome treasure, and then you have to wait 5 minutes for the Pikmin to take it all the way back to the beginning where your last base was. There's got to be a better way to do that, right?
Right.
So it'd be nice if they moved in that direction. I actually thought the Adolf's idea about the dynamic level designs was actually really cool because, yes, it would be interesting to kind of mess up the level design, you know, or have something happen that would totally change the layout, you know, some kind of flood or something. But also just the like tragic nature of the things he described, wildfires, that to me, that totally fits with Pikmin. Like it's so cute and so harrowing at the same time that I can totally see them doing this.
That would be fun.
Actually, yeah, now that I think about it, like all you do in Pikmin is basically bring stuff back to your base or destroy some gates, things like that. But why not have actual missions, you know, like the fire Pikmin actually save. Well, maybe not a screaming baby. That would be traumatic. But, you know, something from a fire or things like that, actual missions. That could be cool.
Well, they'd have to get over the idea that virtually everything in the world of Pikmin is hostile to the Pikmin.
Hmm.
So there really aren't any friendly animals in Pikmin. It's everything's trying to eat them. They are the bottom of the food chain. But maybe they could be saving other Pikmin. I don't know. Yeah, drawing lines for the Pikmin to follow, that sounds like a really good use of the touchscreen, you know. It's one of the things that back when we were hoping that Pikmin would be on DS one day, that was one of the ideas that was thrown around, and it's not too late, you know, even on the console, it's not too late for that. There are definitely times when you would like to be able to send the Pikmin on a sort of a very specific route, and
so like Yoshi fruit cart them.
Yeah.
There you exactly. go.
Yeah. No, totally. I think that would be really useful in certain scenarios, you know. Baiting creatures with the corpses
with
of their
corpses.
Dead. Is, that seems unlikely, but it's kind of funny. I like that idea. So thank you, sir. I think there are obviously a lot of options for Nintendo to spice up Pikmin 3 and to make it feel different than the previous games in the series. There was some new video footage shown during the Nintendo Direct last week.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't look any different. I mean, they showed some new enemies, but you expect there to be new enemies. They didn't really show anything about the game that you hadn't seen before. There was some nice, you know, kind of like a dark cave that you were in and you couldn't see anything very well. And
fluorescent mushrooms. Phosphorescent.
Yeah, and then one of the enemies was bioluminescent. And so, you know, it would do something and then all of a sudden it would light up the whole room and you could see what was going on, but then it would get dark again. I mean, there's some cool stuff they can do with that, but I still think they need to add some like actual new mechanics and make it feel like Pikmin has evolved as a franchise over the past 10 years. I'm still waiting to see that, but,
maybe they need to put crafting in Pikmin. You know, you're
crafting.
Picking up. Follow me.
Genetic engineering.
Actually,
me.
Pikmin really is already about loot.
You're already picking up all this junk. What if it lets you build like a barricade or that extra base you're talking about?
Hmm. Or at least buy some kind of upgrades to your Pikmin, you know, like get them armor or just level them up in a different way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as it is, you're always finding this nectar kind of in situ and it, right. and it levels them up. But then, you know, it's a very constrained mechanic.
Yeah. It's just, you know, Pikmin plus one. It's really not.
Yeah, it's just the Pikmin are stronger. You know, the bloomed Pikmin are just strictly better than the other ones. And so the whole game becomes, I got to find that nectar. But then once you find enough, all your Pikmin have flowers, and then you don't care anymore. There's nowhere left to go at that point. So expanding on that a little would be good.
But isn't that just life?
It is just life, yes.
That's life. Yeah.
What if you had a Pikmin mortgage?
Oh my God! Add Tom Nook.
Tom Nook
shows
yeah.
up.
Yeah, there we go. The Tom Nook of Pikmin.
All right. So the next email is from Pixelated Pixies. He writes: in recent years, we have seen a concerted effort from Nintendo to improve the services, digital services, and also to support them with their own releases. Despite some welcome improvements in Nintendo's downloadable services, in recent months and years, there have also been several indications that while Nintendo have chosen to embrace digital, they don't quite understand it yet. Why, for instance, have a profile system on Wii U if it's going to be non-migratable? Why release digital versions of retail games if they're going to cost more than their counterparts? Why release 18-plus games at all if, as in the case of Europe, they can only be purchased within a four-hour window in the middle of the night? My question is not, have Nintendo fully embraced downloadable services? I think it's pretty clear they have. But rather, does Nintendo fundamentally misunderstand why and how gamers might want to use such services?
It's the best ever. Children won't buy this if they have to buy it after 11 p.m.
Well, that's, to be fair, that's not really Nintendo's choice.
Yeah, that's law.
That's German law, and it's because Nintendo of Europe is based in Germany, and I'm sure they would prefer not to do that.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous, but that's on Germany, not on Nintendo Europe.
Oh, they just need to get a post office box in Poland. I bet they don't give a shit. Nope, we're based in Poland.
I don't understand why they can't do, you know, IP locking. So, you know, that would only apply if you're trying to buy them from within Germany.
So if you're getting Nintendo Video and you're in Europe, you still have to be in the right country for your Nintendo Video content.
Oh, so they can do it for that, but they can't do it for the store.
Yeah, so if your 3DS is from, say, France, and you're in another country in Europe, you won't be able to get video until you come back to France.
Well, I mean, Johnny, they don't want children border hopping just so they can download games. Europe's a very small place. It's not.
I'm gonna buy a ticket on the France to Germany train so I can get a freaking copy of Zombie U.
Man, it's Sunday. I gotta get my drink on. I'm gonna have to head over the state line.
Oh,
I've been there. Yeah, I mean. This is interesting. I think it's not so much that Nintendo doesn't understand these services. I think it's, you know, there are very clear, obvious examples that they could follow that have been set by Valve, Microsoft, Sony, other companies, you know, Apple. There are a lot of different ways to do this, to sell games online, have them download directly to your platform. And I think it's not that Nintendo doesn't know that those other services are available. I think it's not that they don't understand what makes them work. I think Nintendo, there's a certain hubris here, and maybe it's valid, but I think Nintendo feels that their way is better. And the differences between their system and the way other people do it are intentional, and they believe that it protects the consumer, or it protects their profit line, protects our shareholders, or it, you know, prevents piracy. I think the profile migration thing, it comes down to piracy on some level. It may be misguided. It may not be a very effective way to prevent that, but I think that's their thinking. And over time, these stances may evolve. They've done this in the past. You know, they added the SD card channel on Wii. They finally added demos for WiiWare and stuff like that. You know, now they're letting you buy retail games over download, which they're actually ahead of a lot of the other companies in that respect. I think they will evolve these over time as they see what does work and what doesn't work. But in general, I think they're doing things in a certain way because they think they just know how to do it better than other people. You know, we think it doesn't match up with our expectations. You know, time will tell whether they can keep it up.
Yeah, I don't know. great answer. It's just, I mean, I haven't used their digital platforms that much in that respect, in part because I'm still smarting from having to go through the Wii Shop channel for 7 years.
Well, they've come a long way from that.
Oh, I know they have, but it's going to be hard for me to adapt to the world in which they behave competently. And I do think ultimately they are more or less competent at this point. I mean, they still have improvements that we would like to see them make. More games, like the Wii U, more games need demos. It's ridiculous right now. There's what, 2 demos on the Wii U eShop right now?
I think there's 3 as of 3. Today.
Yeah. That's not great. And
that's a far cry from Microsoft.
Yeah. No, but look, this is still we're weeks from launch. So there might be a certain amount, but
these are things that have been established in the previous channel.
Yeah, but at this point on the 3DS, we didn't even have a shop.
Well, that's because the 3DS came out half finished.
Yeah,
well,
sure.
Yes, it did.
But I mean, like, yeah. And
at this point in the Sonic and racing, we didn't even have multiplayer. What's your point? Boom. All
right, but like, you know, like, supposedly the functionality to have sales on the Wii U eShop wasn't ready for launch. So they're still putting things together. I'm sure that we're going to see a lot of changes in the coming weeks and the coming months. I'm sure that the demos won't always be absolutely impossible to find. right. And at some point, like, they're actually going to showcase them. It's just a matter of time.
It's good, but I have my Wii U right now.
Right. There's stuff that they need to do to catch up to everybody else. I mean, yeah, this is a far cry from where they were. Remember, the DS had demos. Remember how to get to those?
Mm-hmm. You had to go through the Wii.
They're not all the way there yet.
No, they're not. No. But here's the thing. I mean, what we've seen is that the more money Nintendo makes on these digital platforms, the more they embrace it.
Well, yeah.
And
I mean,
it's been ramping up steadily over the past 6 or 7 years. And now they're at the point where they're selling their first party games through this. That is pure profit.
Oh, yeah.
Pure profit. They're not paying anybody anything. When you pay $60 to download New Super Mario Bros. U, that is $60 in Nintendo's pocket, period. They love this. They are going to do everything possible to make it as easy for you to do that as it can be. And now they're giving incentives, you know, for people who bought the deluxe system. They're giving you incentives to actually do that because they make more money that way. And now it's more appealing to you to do it that way. So I know it's easy for us to just always assume that Nintendo is in the medieval times when it comes to online stuff.
They're actually at a medieval times
but
restaurant.
They're
right now.
Actually getting pretty smart about it. It's a good thing. I'm very happy with this.
To me, right now, the one thing they need to work on, and this isn't really from a me standpoint, this is for them, is I would say about 2/3 of this online content I've bought on my Xbox has been impulse buys. I have never, ever impulse bought anything ever from a Nintendo download service. Because it's not set up to do that. Even the new eShop.
They don't advertise what's for sale on your home screen of the system. That's something Microsoft does better than anybody. It drives most people crazy.
Yeah.
But on a Nintendo system, if you want to buy something, you have to go to the shop and open it. So you're already in the mindset that you're going there to shop for something. Whereas Microsoft's like, oh, you turned on your system? Try this.
Yeah, and you know what? I try this. I go there. There's a demo. I can download it. And then at the end of the demo, I can say, yeah, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
That's where they need to get. They need to get to the – I don't mind being advertised to on the front page if it's for stuff that's actually good. If they're telling me, hey, this game just came out and it's from a third party, but we think it's really good. You should go play it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, fine. Do that, Nintendo. I don't care. That's fine.
Microsoft does that really well, but I mean there are things Nintendo does better than Microsoft. You can't download Halo 4 right now.
I agree. No, I agree.
Well, I mean,
you can
on BitTorrent, and you could before that came out, but you can't pay $60 to Microsoft to download Halo 4. If you could, I might have already done it.
I agree.
But as it is, I'm waiting, and on the same, you know, in the same breath, I think it's fair to criticize Nintendo for not having all their games up for retail. They have all their first-party games, but I still can't download Call of Duty on my Wii U, and I'm probably not going to get that game until I can. Because of the digital deluxe thing, I have a very strong incentive to wait for that game to either get a significant price drop on a retail physical copy that I don't even really want, or wait until they finally get their shit together and put it up on there. But that's probably on Activision more than Nintendo.
No, I'm sure it is. I mean, like I was saying, this is more for Nintendo than for me. I mean, if I were an investor at one of those Iwata meetings, that's what I'd ask. I'd be like, what are you doing to drive the impulse sales? Because,
well, what they are doing right now is that they have the Miiverse, and they have Miis from, you know, all your friends and all people that you don't even know have, you know, posting from games about these games. And when you click on one of them, like, okay, you have to actually click on them. But if you do, there's a link to their profile. There's also a link to the eShop where you can check out the game that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those, you know, like some people are really, really insanely good at doodling. And, you know, like, who knows? Maybe at some point you're really impressed. You click on something and you actually go on the forums, the Miiverse, and you ask, like, so how is this game? And, you know, like, that seems to be their model right now.
Yeah. I mean,
are those people going to start earning a commission?
Probably not. No.
No. I mean, but the thing is, that is all well and good, but I'm more inclined to click on the sketch of Finn and Jake from Adventure Time dressed up like Kiss coming out of the Family Party 30 Great Games Obstacle Arcade. It's got nothing to do with that game, and I seriously doubt the person who drew that even has the game, but they wanted an opportunity to stretch their artistic talents. Go ahead, that drawing was awesome. You get a yeah.
That didn't make you want to download 30 great party games?
At some point, your finger is going to slip and you're going to buy that game accidentally.
To be fair, like I said in the staff meeting, I'm waiting for the adult party 30 great games obstacle arcade. The one with the swearing and the nudity.
I think Ubisoft tried to release that in Europe on Wii.
We Dare.
Oh.
We Dare.
Oh, what is
what
an
a
obstacle?
Great title.
Oh god.
So Guillaume has the next email.
TJ Spike writes, with BioWare being open to releasing the Mass Effect trilogy on Wii U, how can gamers help encourage them to do it?
Well, what do you guys think? Should people vote with their dollars and go ahead and buy Mass Effect 3 on
Wii
U?
Fuck that.
I already have all the Mass Effect games. I just don't know that there's much money in it for them. Yeah. I mean, I could try to come up with mechanisms to compel them to do it, but ultimately, I just don't know where the money is. I mean, Mass Effect 1's a 5-year-old game?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think if you're the kind of person that wants to play Mass Effect, you probably already have something that can play Mass Effect.
Well, and you've probably already
and even if you're not, even if you're not, I mean, I don't know that. Yeah, it's not worth it on their end, and I don't think there's anything you can do to convince them, because it doesn't even look like they put much effort into the Wii U port in the first place.
No.
Well, supposedly the port is actually pretty good.
It has some performance problems, but they shipped it out to an Australian studio and gave them very little time to do it, you know, which is the same thing that happened with Batman and some of the other, you know, ports to Wii U. Mm-hmm. And, you know, luckily, it sounds like it's fairly playable and it's not too bad. But
I mean, keep in mind, when they released Mass Effect 3 on the PS3, they didn't do this. And that has a much higher install base. It was much more likely to have people who haven't played the other games if you exclusively owned one console or the other.
Well, they did eventually release the trilogy on PS3.
Eventually,
that's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
I've never played Mass Effect personally, and I am the kind of person who will buy, say, Night Sky for $10 on the eShop instead of paying $1 on Steam, just because I do like playing my Nintendo consoles more sometimes, and I like the experience more. I like, perhaps Miiverse could be some sort of selling point for me as well. But it really pales in comparison with the fact that right now I could go to my PlayStation 3 and download the original for $15.
Yeah.
Yep.
I could stop there, you know, like I don't have to buy the trilogy, like just the first one, $15. And, you know, no, I'm not engaged to do anything, you know, like I don't have to buy the rest. But yeah.
I mean, I could go to GameStop right now and buy, and I will at some point, buy the 360 version of Mass Effect 3 for half the price of the Wii U one.
Sure.
I mean, there's almost a value proposition at such a point where you could say, well, I could buy a cheap 360 and get the games at almost the same price.
Yeah, we're not there yet. But I think that the chances of the trilogy coming out at this point are low, and it's too bad, you know, that that EA decided to release only 3 and not the trilogy for Wii U. But I think, you know, releasing the trilogy on Wii U would have been a lot more work than releasing it on the other systems they already had the engine working. They would have had to add all this interface stuff for the Wii U version that would have been a lot, you know, would have gotten them out of the launch window. And that's why they didn't do it. You know, they felt they could get the third game alone done in time for the launch window. And they didn't feel they could get the trilogy done in time. It's 3 games. None of them were on Nintendo hardware previously, so they would have had to, you know, do a lot of work on them. And that's why it happened. If you still want the trilogy on Wii U, again, I think it's very unlikely, but the best way to do it is not to buy Mass Effect 3, but to email EA or tweet them or post on their Facebook page or write them a letter on paper with a pen.
Well, there is a petition right now going on, right?
Shh. Okay, sure. Do that too.
Maybe it'll come to Ouya.
There you go. $99 well spent.
Yeah. The best way is to communicate directly with the company, and then if they hear from enough people who are like-minded as you, maybe they will do some marketing analysis and determine that, hey, maybe it is, you know, cost-effective for us to go through this process. But the longer they wait, I think the less awareness there is, and they'll probably feel like the demand isn't there anymore. So go ahead and do it now, and maybe, you know, halfway through next year, they'll be able to pull it off. But just don't overlook the amount of work that would be required to go into this, and especially considering now you have some portion of people among the Wii U owners who've already played the third game on the Wii U. They may not feel like they want to go back and buy the whole package. They say, well, I already know how it ends. I've already played a third of that. I really don't want to pay for it again.
No, and it's so dependent on your progress in the previous games.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it would be interesting to play through the first two and then see how your choices affect a replay of the third, but I don't know how many people would do that.
I think it would be justifiable, and it would actually stir up some interest in the larger gaming industry if BioWare and EA went back and said, okay, let's really polish up and do like a kind of, you know, let's do like the final ultimate version of Mass Effect 1 and 2. Let's fix the bugs. Let's, you know, even them out. Let's up the graphics to make it closer to 3. And let's do like the ultimate versions of these and then put out the ultimate Mass Effect trilogy on Wii U. But that would be very expensive. It would take a lot of effort. And I don't see that there's a market to justify that, you know?
No.
And the problem is they can't then just go and release that also on all these other platforms because they just already released the trilogy. So they're not going to do it again a year later. It's a tough sell. It's a tough sell. I hate to be pessimistic about it, but you know, I think James is on the right track here. If you really want to play the first couple of games, you might be better off finding like a used 360 or you know, the cheapest possible model you can find and just go buy old copies of those games and play them on that, because I really doubt Mass Effect 1 and 2 are coming to Wii U anytime soon.
You could probably get a used copy of Mass Effect 1 for $5
for 360. Yeah, sure. It's also on PC. You know, if you have a PC, I'm sure you don't need a state-of-the-art PC to run Mass Effect.
No, anymore. And the PC version is already the secret ultimate version.
I was going to say.
There you go. Go to Origin and see if they put it on sale for Christmas or something. Really, you know. Well, guys, that's going to be the end of the show. So thanks, everybody, for emailing. The address, of course, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we hope to hear from you soon when we do some more letters like this. Before we go, I want to give Nathan a very big thank you for being our guest this week and a chance to plug what you do these days.
You know, I'm almost scared of telling people that I write for TouchGen because most people just come to my reviews and yell at me. But go ahead and read what I write on TouchGen.net and yell at me, please. And yeah, thanks for having me on. It's a real treat.
Well, that's very kind, and I really appreciate it. You did a great job, and it's a big help to us. Our carousel of guests on the podcast has actually turned out to be a very fun experience, and it's helped soothe over the pain of being without our friend John Lindemann. But we do
pain.
Hope to have him back soon, and I really truly appreciate the help from you, Nathan, and everybody else who's been willing to come on the show and fill in for him. also wanted to note that next week, we are hoping to do a show right before Christmas. It's probably going to be really short, so just be prepared for that. And I'm certainly not guaranteeing anything, but that's our plan right now, is to record a short show, do it early, and have time to edit it before everybody runs off to their various, Christmas destinations. And then after that, I think we're just going to take the week off. It'll be the week between Christmas and New Year's. I certainly will be traveling. Some of these guys might be as well. And it would be difficult to get everybody together. So we're probably just going to take that week off entirely. Then we'll come back the first week of January for a brand new year of RFN and hopefully the return of John Lindemann. He had told us that he'd probably be coming back around the beginning of the year. And I'm going to try to hold him to that. So don't hold your breath, but maybe we can... rope him back in here pretty soon. So that's all. Don't forget to play Majora's Mask. I'm not going to say anything about emulation, but yeah, there are ways to get it.
Get your mask on, son.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about Majora's Mask the first week back in January, but it will be not too long after that. And with the holidays coming up, it's probably a good time to get some serious hours into that game. It's really fantastic. I'm glad to hear that some people are going to be trying it for the first time. So that's all. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
All right.
Later.
Amy? Like, what the fuck? Like, she's just like a pink Sonic.
She's a pink Sonic in drag, yes.
Ah, it's
well,
pretty awful.
Have you ever been on the internet? Because,
No, don't.
Yeah, let's not go there. Let's not go there.
The very first fanfic I ever read, on accident, mind you, involved the word Sonic and the word manhood.
There is a...
that's a funny coincidence, because the very first fanfic I ever wrote involved the word...
Oh, no! I'm Greybrick, G-R-E-Y-B-R-I-C-K. Please do not add me if you're the guy commenting on my Grand Theft Auto Vice City review. if you just want to yell at me, the man who called me Nathan Mustafa backup plan because you're not good at reviews... I do have a backup plan. It's called being a very successful engineer. Thank you very much.
That was, you know, be as negative as that was, I appreciate the effort there. That was...
Well, you know, he also said that I pointed out that in GTA, maybe it's not so fun to drive for, you know, a long time between every mission. And his only response is, no shit. And it's like, well, that's still not fun. I don't know.
So he agrees with
that. I don't particularly find driving from A to B in my current life to be real fun, and I have a nice vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
it's a fun car to drive, but if I'm driving to get eggs, I'm not going to go, this is great. Yeah. Let's get some motherfucking
thanks
eggs.
Thanks to that guy. Just please don't add me.